of the other of that question. Should we stone her or should we not? And again, Jesus' answer is, no, actually, you're thinking about this completely the wrong way. And he takes their mind to the answer that we know well. Two more examples. The next one is in John chapter 5. So if you come with me to John chapter 5, and we'll read verses 1 to 5. It says, after this, there was a feast of the Jews, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. Now there is in Jerusalem by the sheep gate a pool, in Aramaic called Bethesda, which has five roofed colonnades. In these lay a multitude of invalids, blind, lame, and paralyzed. One man was there who had been an invalid for 38 years. So I love the imagery here that in the story that links this man or this experience to the nation of Israel. You have these five pillars. You have the 38 years that the people of Israel were in the desert. But these pillars or these colonnades are roofed, which suggests that as your eye is drawn to them and your eyes start to go up to heaven, there's a roof there and you stop short. Or you have the 38 years, which remind you of the people of Israel, but it's 38 years where theoretically, they were free, but not really. They were still, in some ways, crippled. So the drama that arises around this situation is, of course, that Jesus has healed this man on the Sabbath. And the question isn't put to him quite as explicitly, but the question is essentially, should we be healing people on the Sabbath, or should we be healing them on normal working days? And again, the answer of Jesus is, no, that's the wrong question. The right question should be when someone is sick is the right time to heal them. And let's look at one more example in John chapter 3. And I love these conversations in the book of John. But this one is a little bit different. It doesn't quite fall into the pattern. And probably because this is a Pharisee, and Pharisees don't necessarily ask questions as much. They think they've got it all figured out. So if we read John chapter 3, the first couple verses, it says, now there was a man of the Pharisees named Nicodemus, a ruler of the Jews. And this man came to Jesus by night and said to him, Rabbi, we know that you are a teacher come from God, for no one can do these things that you do unless God is with him. So in simplest terms, Jesus' response to him is, no, it's you have not understood anything of what you have seen, and you have no clue who I really am. And Jesus says that kind of indirectly by completely changing the subject, and then he circles back around to what Nicodemus affirmed in verse 11. He says, truly, truly, I say to you, we speak of what we know, and we bear witness to what we have seen, but you do not receive our testimony. So again, here's Nicodemus, where he has observed something, and he thinks he understands what's going on, and he makes this affirmation to Jesus, and Jesus' response is, no, you are not understanding what is actually happening here. So why are we looking at these? You know, what can we learn or benefit from each of these conversations? Well, I think individually there's lessons for us in each one of these instances. So in John chapter 4, perhaps like the woman at the well, our key question where we're at right now is that we think that somehow our style of worship or maybe our race or maybe our nation or our geography or the brand that we have in our worship, we think that that's the defining thing in our relationship with God. And Jesus is saying, actually, no. The defining thing is the nature of our relationship with God ourselves, and those things are all external. They're side issues. Or perhaps if we think of the blind man, when we see people going through challenging circumstances, we might ask ourselves, well, what did they do? Or, you know, what's going on? Like, why is this happening to them? And really the question that we should be asking is, how could the works of God be displayed in this situation? Or maybe even more pointedly, how could I make the works of God be known in this situation? Or maybe like the group that dragged the adulterous woman out in the open to shame her. When we see someone sinning, we might think that it's our job to catch them up or that it's our job to make things right. But Jesus seems to suggest that when we see someone else sinning or someone else make mistakes, that really what we should be asking or what we should be thinking is like, wow, even that person can fall into sin. And if they can fall into sin, what might I be doing or what might be happening in my own life? Or maybe we fall into the error of the people in John chapter 5, that when something good needs to be done, we get caught up on, is this the right time, or am I the right person, or are these the right circumstances to do that? When Jesus is saying, the only question we should be asking is, what is the right thing to do right now? What do I have to do that is good today? Or maybe like Nicodemus, we think we have everything figured out. We look at what Jesus has done. We look at his works and we go, yeah, I know who you are. I know what you've come for. I know what your mission is. I understand. And maybe like Nicodemus, actually what we need is we need to completely tear everything down and begin again. Maybe like Nicodemus, whether we're old or whether we're young, we just need to be born again. So I think from each of these individual conversations, there's things that we could learn. Like we may be in any one of these situations where we're kind of stuck in sort of a simplistic, immature framework of what our religion is about. And no one escapes these conversations with Christ unscathed. As I was telling Mark at the break, no one comes into a conversation with Christ and comes away thinking, yeah, I do have this thing nailed. I am on the right track. And so it would be unusual to expect that we would come into a conversation with Christ and come away feeling completely comfortable with the situation that we're in. And so, Christ is someone who is continually challenging the established paradigms of the people he's working with. So as someone who is a member of an inherently conservative community, I find it very encouraging that Christ is challenging things all the time, that he's always asking questions, because I feel like I'm always asking questions too. And I think that that's a good model to follow. So that, of course, is just another simplification. You know, that's just another conversation that we could have with Christ where we would think that, yeah, I'm in a good place because Jesus questions things, and so I question things too. So I feel safe in where I am in my faith right now. And if I had that conversation with Jesus, you know, should I be someone who's always questioning things, or should I be sticking to the traditions of my community? I imagine that Jesus would say, no, but are you esteeming each of your brothers and sisters as better than yourself? And so I think there's lessons for each of us in the individual conversations. I think the bigger lesson is that we need to every day be looking at ourselves and whether we feel comfortable at the spot where we're at in our faith. And if we do feel comfortable, we should probably be elevating to a different level. I'd like to end with one more conversation in John. And it seems like the pattern of the book is there's these cycles of conversations through the first 11 chapters or so, and this may be the culminating one. So this is Jesus' conversation with Martha in John 11. John 11, verses 21 and 22. So Jesus has come back now. He's back at Bethany. John 11, 21 and 22. And Martha said to Jesus, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. But even now, I know that whatever you ask from God, God will give you. So in a little bit, this is a moment kind of like Nicodemus's, where she's not asking a direct question, but she thinks she's understanding who Jesus is and what he can do. And when Jesus answers her in verse 23, he says, your brother will rise again. And in verse 24, I see a moment similar to like the woman at the well, where she's starting to intuit that he's a prophet, that he's more than what she anticipated or what she had thought. And in verse 24, Martha says to him, I know that he will rise again in the resurrection at the last days. But I see her just, she's not really sure where he's going with when he's saying your brother will rise again. And the culmination of this conversation is, I think, in verse 25, where Jesus says to her, I am the resurrection and the life. And so the important thing here is not particularly the mechanics and the timing of the resurrection. It's not how exactly it's going to take place, but understanding that Jesus is the resurrection and the life. And I think Martha does understand it. He talks to her in verse 25 and continues, whoever believes in me, though he die, yet shall he live. And everyone who lives and believes in me shall never die. Do you believe this? And her answer isn't about the mechanics and the timing of the resurrection. Her answer is, yes, Lord, I believe that you are the Christ, the Son of God, who is coming into the world. And I believe this should be our culminating conversation with Jesus, is understanding that he is a great teacher. He does ask us to elevate our thinking. He's a great leader. He will be our king. He will establish the kingdom. But more than all those things, Jesus is our life. And so that's what we come to remember this morning. When we take these symbols, when we share in the bread and we share in the wine, what we are saying is that we believe that to the extent to which we take Jesus into our lives, his life will be part of ours, and we will have fellowship with him and with the Father in him. Thank you.